Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, Elvin Calendra. Thank you, Elvin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma. Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to discuss about the management of feline tarsal injuries. So if we just start with a couple of learning outcomes, so hopefully by the end of the lecture, you'll be able to confidently be able to describe the anatomy of the feline tarsus on radiographs, and then subsequently outline the different methods of investigation we have for feline tarsal injuries. And then finally, the management options that are available for these different feline tarsal injuries depending on the nature of the injuries. So first of all, let's start with the tarsal anatomy. And before we go into that, though, I've got a set of radiographs here which we'll come onto at the end of the presentation, but I want everyone to take a couple of minutes here looking at these radiographs and try to classify the nature of the injury they can see, and finally how they would go on to manage this case if it was presented to them. Okay. So moving on to the tarsal anatomy. So on the left of your screen you should have a set of x-rays here. And this is a craniocaudal view of the feline tarsus, and then here we've got a schematic view on the right. So if we start proximally, this point here is the medial malleolus, which you can see here, which corresponds to this portion on the radiograph. And the medial malleolus is the origin of the medial collateral ligaments, but it also forms part of the articular surface of the tarsal crural joint. On the lateral aspect, we have the lateral malleolus, which is the distal aspect of the fibula, which corresponds to the origin of the lateral collateral ligaments. The fibula is attached to the tibia by a tibiofibular ligament, which we can see here. And radiographically, obviously, we won't see this because it's of soft tissue opacity. Moving distally, we've got the talus, which forms the main articulation with the tibia for the tarsal crural joint here. And so this is the talus here. The talus articulates with the central tarsal bone. This is the central tarsal bone here. And on the lateral aspect, we have the calcaneus here, and that articulates with the fourth tarsal bone, which is the fourth. This is the fourth tarsal bone here. So of the distal row of tarsal bones that we have, so we have the first, second, third, and fourth. The fourth is by far the biggest tarsal bone that we have. And then right at the bottom here, we have the metatarsal bones. Now, if we go into the next screen, we can see how the different bones that we've just discussed correspond to the distal different articulations we see. So the tarsal crural joint is the articulation formed between the tibia and the talus here. So again, here, this is the tarsal crural joint, and that tarsal crural joint is responsible for the main amount of motion in the joint. So that's quite a high motion joint that we see. It's also the articulation of the tarsal crural joint corresponds to here the lateral malleolus here. And then as we go further distally, we have the talocentral joint, which is the joint formed between the talus and the central tarsal bone. And then on the lateral aspect here, we have the calcaneoquartal joint, which is a joint formed between the calcaneus here and the fourth tarsal bone. Distal to the central tarsal bone, we have the central distal joint, which is this joint here, so we can see it here. And this central distal joint is a joint formed between the central tarsal bone and the smaller number tarsal bones. And then finally, we have the tarsal metatarsal joint here, which is a joint formed between the smaller number tarsal bones and the metatarsus. Now, if we move on to the collateral ligaments, there are some fundamentals in the difference between anatomies between dogs and cats. So in dogs, we talk about long and short collaterals. But unlike dogs, cats do not have long collateral ligaments. They only have short collateral ligaments. And what we have is the medial and the lateral collateral ligaments. but the medial and lateral short collateral ligaments consist of straight and oblique branches. So the oblique branch of the medial collateral ligament is known as the tibio-talar portion, and that portion is partially hidden deep to the medial malleolus. So it's actually very difficult to see from a medial approach that ligament. The straight branch, however, of the medial collateral ligament is the tibiocentral ligament, and that inserts on the dorsomedial process of the central tarsal bone, and that's the ligament that we can see here. Okay. Now, on the lateral aspect, we have the lateral collateral ligament, and that also has an oblique talar fibular ligament, and that oblique talar fibular ligament can be seen here. And again, that we have a talar fibular ligament which is deep to the underside of the lateral malleolus, which is very difficult to see as well. And then we have the calcaneofibular ligament of the lateral collateral, and that has a straight and an oblique branch here, which is here and here. So moving on, now we need to, when we're presented with these cases, we have to remember to assess them globally and not just concentrate on their orthopedic injuries. So it's important to take a thorough history and physical examination. Before we do our orthopedic examination, we'd start off with a general physical examination, which includes the major body system assessment. So when I talk about a major body system assessment, I'm talking about the neurological system, the cardiovascular system, and the respiratory system. So all of those need to be assessed before we go on to the orthopedic part of the examination. Once we're happy that the animal is cardiovascularly stable, it's respiratory stable, and there aren't more pressing life-threatening injuries which needs to be addressed, we can move on to our full body orthopedic examination. And what I would say is often these animals will come in and they'll be in a lot of pain, but I think it is important that if you can, that you assess these animals for deep pain prior to any administrations of opioids, because administrations of opioids prior to examining these patients thoroughly, it is possible that you could mask the presence of deep pain with your opioids. But as soon as you're happy that these animals are deep pain positive and you've done your examination, then obviously we need to give appropriate analgesia to these cases. So blood work, emergency database such as PCV, total solids, I'll also look at other parameters such as urea and creatinine for kidney function. And then I would also advocate that you routinely perform thoracic radiographs for these patients, as it's not uncommon for them to have concurrent injuries elsewhere. With the thoracic radiographs, it's also important to bear in mind that there are certain types of injuries that cats can have that aren't immediately visible on radiographs and only will become visible approximately 48 to 72 hours later. And a prime example of that is pulmonary contusions. So depending on when you see the patient in acute injuries, if they have pulmonary contusions, you won't see them initially radiographically, but if you repeat radiographs after 48 to 72 hours, you will see these pulmonary contusions. And they are often also seen with rib fractures. In terms of a free fluid check, I think with these trauma patients, it's very good just to quickly assess them for the evidence of any free fluid within the abdomen or the thoracic cavity. If there is free fluid within the abdomen, then a sample of that fluid should be taken, and basic biochemical analysis, for example, for urea and creatinine, should be performed and compared to systemic values of urea and creatinine, and this will help rule in or rule out whether the fluid is urine and a uroabdomen is present. Cytology of the fluid should be done to rule out a septic peritonitis process. So, are there any intracellular bacteria? And finally, a bilirubin can also be performed to rule out bile peritonitis. So, this is a cat which has had tarsal injuries, but radiographically we can also see there's something else going on here. So what we immediately see is there is loss of the diaphragmatic outline. We have border effacement of the cardiac silhouette. So when we talk about border effacement of the cardiac silhouette, we can no longer see the clear defined outlines of the cardiac silhouette because it's adjacent to it, there's a soft tissue opacity. There's this loop of intestine, which is cranial displaced, which we wouldn't expect there. And again, on the Dorsiventral, we can see this loop here. We can see displacement of the trochea to the right side, and there's also a soft tissue opacity between the lung lobes and the thoracic wall, which is consistent with a pleural effusion of fluid. So all of these findings are consistent with a diaphragmatic rupture in this case, and obviously this was addressed first before its orthopedic injuries were addressed. Things not to remember if you do see radiographs and your biochemical parameters are elevated is that they could be urogenital trauma. And here we can see there's a lot of soft tissue swelling around the perineal region here. And this CAD had a retrograde contrast study performed. Now, this contrast study is not ideal because ideally the tip of the catheter should be placed in the penis here. And injection of contrast materials, you should see the urethra outlined and the bladder filling more cranially. So in this scenario, what we did was we did an anterior grade cystogram. So we put a catheter needle directly into the bladder and we injected contrast. And here we can see there's contrast extravasation here, which is characteristic for a urethral rupture. And again, this cat, which had urethral trauma, this was managed first before the orthopedic injuries were addressed. So moving on, when you have a patient presents to you with these types of injuries, which an open tarsal crural luxation and a large degree of soft tissue injuries, you always have to ask yourself what your options are. So generally we're talking about we can amputate the leg because we don't think it's salvageable. We may consider that the leg is salvageable and we can continue with surgical stabilization, or we're not sure the state of the leg and we need more information, or we say that we can say that it's not possible to say from this picture. And with all of those scenarios, I would say that it is not, just looking at a picture, it's not possible, so we need to have a bit more information. And so what information is useful to for us as surgeons to helping decide whether we can salvage the leg or not? So does the limb have a distal pulse? So the pulse can either be palpated in the metatarsal region, or we can use Doppler to place on the metatarsal region to see whether an audible pulse is can be heard. We can cut the nail short to see whether the quicks in the nails bleed, and if the nails are bleeding, that would be a good indication that the distal limb is perfused. More subjectively, is the limb cold? Is it warm? And does it bleed, for example, when we take a hypodermic needle and we put the needle into the digital pads and the tarsal pads? Is there any bleeding of those pads? All of those are good signs that the distal limb is perfused and that it would be appropriate to go on in time and with regards to a procedure to stabilize the leg and try and save the leg. What is the neurological status of the leg? As we said previously, it's important to check that these patients have deep pain present. And finally, if at all you're not certain what the state of the leg is and which way it's going to go, take a bit of time. So just do basic wound management in these cases and come back and reevaluate the leg in 24 hours and 48 hours. And typically what you see is if the leg is non-viable and it's poorly perfused, and the vascular supply is compromised, is that over time it will become very evident that the leg won't be salvageable, and at that point you can make the decision to amputate rather than spending a lot of money and time and putting the animal through an unnecessary procedure which is likely to lead to poor function of the leg and potentially amputation further down the line. So other things that we can do is we can carefully palpate the tarsus to help identify whether there's any other instability. So if we look at this video here, we can see what I've essentially done is I've grasped the calcaneus with one hand, and then with my other hand I'm putting plantar pressure and flexing and extending the metatarsus. So by doing that, I'm isolating the calcaneal quartal joints, or the joints which are distal to the tarsal crural joint. So if I did not stabilize the calcaneus, if you flex and extend the hock joint, you're essentially flexing and extending the tarsal crural joint. But by grasping the calcaneus with one hand, you are stabilizing all of the joints distal to the tarsal crural joint, and that will help whether to identify whether there's any instability present. So in the normal animal, there should be no flexion or extension when you grasp the calcaneus there, because the calcaneal quartal and the distal and tarsal joints should be stable. So following our orthopedic and neurologic examinations, I think it's important to say that the fracture is stabilized as soon as possible. But before we do that, we need to think about pain relief for these patients. So typically we're talking about some kind of opioids and non-steroidals as well. Now, it's important to assess that the patient is cardiovascularly stable. There's no renal disease or any other contraindications which would prevent us from giving non-steroidals. But if you're happy with the patient otherwise, then there's no reason that non-steroidals can't be given. A Robert Jones dressing can be applied as a temporary stabilization method prior to surgery for these tarsal crural joints as well. But before that, we also need to consider basic first aid wound management. So in these cases, what I typically do is we get a sterile water-soluble lubricant that we can place into the wound. Once I've placed that into the wound, be very aggressive with your and liberal with your clipping. So you clip the surrounding areas, and don't worry too much if hair goes into the wound, because the hair should be caught by your water-soluble lubricant. Once you have got you've clipped thoroughly, then we can think about flushing the wound with sterile saline. They typically talk about doing that with a 35 mil syringe and an 18 gauge needle, and that will give you approximately 7 to 8 psi. But generally, there's 20 mil syringes or 50 mil syringes, so I use a 20 mil syringe. Once we flush the wound thoroughly, then we consider taking a bacteriology swab. The reason we don't take a bacteriology swab prior to flushing is because we want to make sure that the bacteriology swab that we take is a true representative of what contaminants are left after the wound has been flushed and cleaned. If we take the bacteriology swab prior to flushing, then what we could get is essentially just a contaminant which is on the road rather than the bacteria which has been left over after we've cleaned the wound. Following that, I typically start these animals on empirical antibiotics with amoxicillin and clavulanic acid. I think it's a good choice of antibiotics because it's got a broad spectrum covering both anaerobic bacteria as well as having a broad spectrum for staphylococci and E. coli. And then finally, we think about dressing the wound. And in these cases where it's very difficult to dress the wound, in the inguinal or the axillary area, we can think about doing a tie-over dressing here, which we put loops of sutures around the wound here, and then we can pack it with a wet to dry dressing, and then we use umbilical dressing to close the wound through the ties that we've placed surrounding the wound. So once we've done all that, we need to consider preoperative radiographs. So we always do orthogonal radiographs. So those are perpendicular radiographs, so two views. So we do craniocaudal and or dorsoplantar and mediolateral radiographs of the tarsus. If you've got any doubt about what's normal or abnormal, then the easiest thing to do is take the other leg, the contralateral leg, and that will help you identify whether it's an anatomical variant and it's seen in both legs, or it's true pathology or trauma that you're seeing, and that is the cause of the abnormality. Always remember that if you don't see any bony injuries, that the only way to truly assess the soft tissue structures is to take stress radiographs. There are obviously going to be certain cases when stress radiographs aren't required, such as this, when you're presented with an animal with a gross obvious tarsal crural luxation, there's absolutely no point in taking radiographs. Okay, taking stress radiographs, but we would orthogonal survey radiographs would be absolutely fine in this case. So stress radiographs are important to identify not only the direction of the luxation, so is it unstable in valgus or lateral stress, or varus medial stress, or finally dorsal stress or in so inflection and extension as well, but also the level of the instability. So animals with ligamentous injuries will often have soft tissue swelling centered over the tarsus, and if you see that radiographically, then that should give you a clue that these animals may have soft tissue injuries rather than bone injuries, and I would always think about and consider doing stress radiographs at that point. Now, stress radiographs can be done, as in seen in this picture, by using a combination of leads and sandbags to stress the limbs in valgus and varus, or it's possible also to use sellotape, especially in smaller patients such as cats. And as we said, we stressed it in four directions, so valgus stress, varus stress, and then inflection and extension. So if it's unstable in extension, that means that there is plantar instability. If it's unstable in flexion, that means that there's dorsal instability. So let's now move on to the different types of management options that are available to us. So we'll start off with the tarsal crural joint. So the tarsal crural joint, as we said, is the joint which is responsible for the greatest degree of motion in the hock joint. And tarsal crural luxations often result as multi-ligamentous injuries. So injuries of the collateral ligaments, but it can also happen because of fractures as well. So typically we see tarsal crural instability due to either fracture of the malleoli or damage to the collaterals. But it's possible to have a combination of both of those types of injuries. So based on our imaging findings and our clinical examination, it's important to try and identify what is the underlying cause of the instability that is present. Now, because of the paucity of soft tissue structures in the distal limb, it's not uncommon at all to see wounds or shearing injuries associated with tarsocrural luxations. And also, there's the incidence of open injuries where you have gas around the soft tissues, or you can see an obvious wound, or a piece of bone has penetrated the skin, is a lot higher with tarsal crural luxations than any other luxations, again because of the paucity of the soft tissue structures. And as we said, it's important to identify whether the malleola, there are concurrent malleolar fractures, because both the medial and lateral malleolas form the articulation between the talus and the tibia, and on the lateral aspect, the lateral malleolus will form the articulation between the talus and the fibula, and those are articular fractures, and the principles of articular fracture management, as we know, are accurate reduction, rigid fixation, and compression. So we, if possible, we need to think about trying to fix these type of fractures. So this is a cat which is presented with a tarsal crural luxation, and on the radiographs we can see it has a malleolar fracture. So this here is the lateral malleolus here, but we can also see there is a gas opacity which is present just cranial to the tibia there, which is so on radiographs you can say this is an open fracture, and obviously when we look at the foot we can see there's a large wound associated with the foot as well, a degloving injury. So we have numerous options for treatment of tarsal crural instability. So either we can do primary repair of the ligaments that have been damaged, or we can think about doing prosthetic ligaments. We can also do prosthetic ligaments by drilling bone tunnels at various locations and then putting PDS suture through these bone tunnels. We can place a transarticular external skeletal frame, which is temporary for a period of time, and this frame stays on typically for around 6 weeks, and during this time there is periarticular fibrosis around the joint which will help stabilize the joint, and then the frame is removed. We can think about external coaptation, but be very careful when you're thinking about external coaptation on its own. This will only be suitable and indicated if there's purely dorsal instability. And often, this is very uncommon. Typically, if there's dorsal instability, it's combined with instability immediately laterally or on the plantar aspect. And if that is the case, then external coaptation is not indicated. And then finally, we can think of fusion of the joint, and if we have to fuse a joint, we talk about pantarsal arthrodesis, so we fuse all joint levels. And then finally, the least preferable option is amputation. So when we have a case, as we do in this for this cat, who's got obvious wounds associated with the tarsocrural luxation, then my preference would be to use transarticular external skeletal fixation. So for this case, what we did is basic wound management, as we've previously described, and we waited for there to be a good bed of granulation tissue, which we can see. And this cat actually had bilateral injuries, and so the patient is positioned in dorsal recumbency, and then a transarticular frame was applied. And this is a case series of 17 cats, of all which had disruption to the tarsocrural joint or the distal tibia, and they found that fracture union was achieved in 11 out of the 12 cases, and there were excellent results in 8 cats, and the outcome was satisfactory in a further 5. So this is a bit of an older paper, and there have been more recent papers looking at transarticular fixation as well. So just to recap, with severe soft tissue wounds, what we want to do is to try and minimize the amount of metal implants that are placed adjacent to the joint. But it's also important to recognize that if you have got malleolar fractures, the fractures of the medial malleolus or the lateral malleolus, what we want to try and do is to reconstruct these fractures because they're articular fractures, and we want to try and regain congruency of the joint. My preference for a transarticular frame would be to put 3 pins above and 3 pins below the tarsocrural joint. And what we'd like to do is to place these pins in what we call a far near far principle, so we're spanning as much of the bone as possible. Once we place the transarticular frame, typically I only place it on the medullar aspect, and it's a combination of 1.6 positive end-threaded pins, which I place in the tibia and the talus, and then I pre-drill that with a 1.5 millimeter drill bit, and then in the metatarsus I will use just ordinary 1 or 1.2 millimeter K wires. Once I've placed my frame, then I get another Steinmann pin, and what I do is I connect points A to points B with a connecting bar, and I have a double clamp here, and I have another connecting bar here. That makes it into an A-frame, and an A-frame will be stiffer than a conventional unilateral frame here. You can also do type 2 or modified type 2 frames as well, which have been done here as well, but it is slightly heavier for cats, but they still seem to tolerate them pretty well. So this was a study that we did at the college, looking at 32 cats with tarsocrural luxation, and we found that a high proportion of these cats, approximately 85% of them, had a very good outcome. Owners would often report that these animals would sometimes hold their legs out to one side after the frame had been removed, and would sit with one of their legs abducted and sticking out. But clinically, this did not seem to cause them any problems. So when you place a transarticular external skeletal fixator, if you're using the IMEX system, the IMEX SK system, the connecting bar is of stainless steel. So on your post-op X-rays, what can happen is the stainless steel connecting bar can obscure the tarsocrural joint, and it may be difficult to see your reduction, the quality of your reduction. So there's a couple of things that you can do. You can either curve the connecting bar, which has been done on the bottom radiograph here, in such a way that the tarsocrural joint is still visible, or you can use a single connecting bar here, a single connecting bar here, and connect it with a double clamp. Or you can use a free form epoxy putty frame. So all of those are viable options. My preference would be to use a to curve the connecting bar, and to use rather than using epoxy putty frame, because at 4 weeks or 6 weeks, or when the animal represents for a recheck, I can Loosen the clamps here, take off the connecting bar, assess for stability of the tarsal crawl joint. If I'm unhappy, I can replace the connecting bar. Whereas if you have an epoxy putty frame, that can be more difficult to replace the connecting bar once you've removed it. The tarsal crawl angle is important in CAT. So when we talk about the tarsal crawl angle, we're talking about the angle in which the hock joint is kept in flexion. So when we put the frame on, I would recommend that the frame is put on in a higher degree of flexion than it is in dogs. So typically we're talking about 100 to 110 degrees. And the reason is cats will tolerate flexion more than they will tolerate extension. So if they're too extended in their hock joint, it can often be quite cumbersome for them to walk and they take longer to adapt to it. Whereas if you keep them in flexion, they often adapt very quickly and they start using the legs very quickly with the frame on. Generally, I keep the frame on for approximately 6 weeks, and there is a theoretical argument that the longer the hock joint is immobilized, the greater the damage to the cartilage and the greater the long-term effects in terms of stiffness to the joint. Clinically, we've had frames on for 8 weeks and it doesn't seem to cause a problem. And in our study of 32 cats, we even had one cat with a frame on for 120 days, and clinically it still seemed to do very well. So it's not something that I would advocate that you keep the frame on for longer than 6 to 8 weeks, but it doesn't clinically seem to be a problem in terms of immobilization. And as we said, about 85% of these cases will have an excellent outcome. So this is a cat which had a free form epoxy putty frame here, with 3 pins above, 3 pins below, and then it also had a malleolar fracture, which and a wound which was just pinned back on here. The lateral malleolus was just pinned back on. So this is a radiograph of a cat which has got tarsal crawl instability, and what we can see here is there's a lot of soft tissue swelling centered around the tarsal crawl joint. We can also see what seems to be a small mineralized fragment or chip fragment adjacent to the talar ridge of the talus. But what we can see is once we then stress these radiographs, the joint opens up and we can see that this small chip fragment becomes more visible. So again, just identifying the importance of taking stress radiographs when you have soft tissue swelling centered over the joint and no obvious bony abnormalities that are present. So this was a more recent study which was done looking at the use of bone tunnels and PDS sutures to stabilize the tarsal crawl joint following traumatic luxation. And it was a cadaveric study, and what they did is they identified the location where the bone tunnel should be done or should be performed. And so for me, what I've said, it's important to identify, do these animals have wounds or is the injury closed? So in this cat, the injury is closed. And what we tend to find is when the injuries are closed, that the propensity to form periarticular fibrosis and scar tissue is not as high. And so my preference in these cases is to do an open approach, and to stabilize the hock joint with a combination of PDS and bone tunnels, and then augment that with a transarticular frame. My concern in these cases, if you just put a transarticular frame, is that the amount of periarticular fibrosis that is laid down is not as good as the amount of fibrosis that you get when there is a big open wound present. And so these are pictures directly out of the paper, and they show that bone tunnels can be formed at the level of the medial malleolus and in the central tarsal bone on the medial aspect, and then on the lateral aspect through the lateral malleolus and then through the proximal and distal aspects of the calcaneus as well. And then what we have is we have these two prostheses on the medial aspect and two prostheses, PDS sutures on the lateral aspect. And then what we do is we tie the blue sutures taut when the joint is kept in flexion, and the grey sutures, they're tied taut when the joint is kept in extension. And again, I would also combine this with a temporary transarticular external skeletal fixator. And so this is Diesel, the cat which had the bilateral degloving injuries and shearing injuries. And we can see that in this case, because of the wound and the skin graft that has been performed, a metal frame has been put on the lateral aspect of the joint. Typically, we'll put it on the medial aspect because that's where the safe corridors for the tibia are. But you can also apply it on the lateral aspect as well if you want to try and avoid putting pins through the skin graft, which we did in this case. And this was the outcome of that cat. So it is possible that we can get instability of the tarsocrural joint purely from fractures, and this would occur if you have fractures of both the medial and lateral malleoli. So, because the origins of the collaterals come from the medial and lateral malleoli, once those parts of the bone have fractured, then the joint becomes very unstable. But bone tends to heal better than ligament. So if these pieces of bone are big enough, then what we can do is we can fix the malleoli back on, typically with pin and tension band, a lag screw, or in this case, we've actually even put a tiny iron pin up the fibula and combine that with a small lag screw. Then once you've got stable fixation of your malleolar fractures, then because your collateral ligaments are intact, the joint should become stable. Now the question is, once you've done that, do you augment that with external coaptation, or do you augment it with a temporary transarticular frame? And again, that would be up to the surgeon to make the decision on how stable their fixation was. But if I was relatively happy with my fixation method, I would put the cat in a dressing for approximately 4 to 6 weeks, and then remove the dressing. As we go further distally, we have intertarsal instability. And a common instability that we see is calcaneal quarter instability or talocentral instability. So this is the proximal intertarsal joint. So the calcaneal quarter joint is a joint between the calcaneus and the fourth tarsal bone. So the calcaneus and the fourth tarsal bone are on the lateral aspect, and on the medial aspect we have the talocentral joint, which is a joint between the talus and the central tarsal bone. So the plantar ligament is an important ligament that originates from the distal aspect of the calcaneus, and it inserts on the fourth tarsal bone. And if you have an injury to this ligament, the animal will present with a plantar grade stance, typical to like what we see with Achilles injury. So it's important to try and distinguish between Achilles rupture and damage to the calcaneal quarter joint. And in these cases, because of the high tensile forces that go through that ligament, conservative management won't neutralize these forces. So, on clinical examination, it's possible to differentiate between the calcaneal quarter instabilities or Achilles mechanism disruption. So, with calcaneal quarter instabilities, as we said previously in the video, if you grasp that calcaneus and if you flex and extend the metatarsus, you'll have instability. With an Achilles mechanism disruption, you often have thickening of the insertion point of the Achilles mechanisms on the tuber calcanei, and when you extend the stifle joint, you will be able to independently flex and extend the hock joint if there is Achilles mechanism disruption. In the normal animal, if you flex the stifle joint, you are unable. Sorry, if you extend the stifle joint, you are unable to flex the hock joint independently. So these are radiographs of an animal which has got calcaneal quartal instability. So these aren't stress radiographs. These are just survey radiographs, neutral radiographs. And what immediately we can see is, look at all of this soft tissue swelling that is centered on the plantar aspect of the hock joint and is centered over the calcaneal quarter joint here. And if we compare that to the degree of swelling that we see in a normal hock joint, we can see there's minimal soft tissue swelling here, and the joint space is very small between the calcaneus and the fourth tarsal bone. Whereas here, we can see this opening up of the joint space between the calcaneus and the fourth tarsal bone, and these type of injuries will be unstable in flexion. So, As we move further distally, then we have tarsometatarsal instability, and tarsometatarsal instability may be also due to either ligamentous damage or fractures. And if we have injury to the short distal plantar ligaments, we can have tarsometatarsal injury. Or if we have very proximal fractures of the metatarsal bones where the collateral ligaments insert, we can have avulsion fractures, and that can lead to tarsometatarsal instability. And so when we have instability in the medial, lateral, or plantar plane, that it's important that we recognize that these type of injuries can't be managed conservatively and surgery is recommended. But compared to the tarsocrural joint, the distal intertarsal joints have relatively low motion, and so typically what we do when we treat these cases is we fuse them by some kind of arthrodesis. So a partial tarsal arthrodesis compared to a pantarsal arthrodesis if you wanted to address tarsocrural instability. So if you have just distal intertarsal instability, then you can just do a partial tarsal arthrodesis. So this is a cat which has got a fracture of the proximal fifth metatarsal bone here, and also is comminuted fracture of the fifth metatarsal bone here. And we can see when we take stress radiographs, then the tarsometatarsal joint opens up because the collateral ligaments are inserting on this part of the bone here. So this is an avulsion type fracture. So that type of injury was stabilized with a partial tarsal arthrodesis performed on the lateral aspect with a compression plate. Now there are different types of plates that you can use, but typically one plate that, or one of my the com most, more common types of plate that I use for these injuries is a veterinary instrumentation hybrid plate. It's a hybrid pancarpal arthrodesis plate, but what it does is it allows you to place larger screws in the calcaneus and smaller screws in the metatarsal area. And so you can see the size of the screw holes are differ. So typically in the cat it would be 2 millimeter screws in the calcaneus and 1.5 millimeter screws in the metatarsals. So talocalcaneal luxation is a relatively uncommon injury, and it's seen by displacement of the distal head of the talus, and that typically goes dorsally, and there's disruption of the ligament between that holds the talus between the calcaneus, so the talocalcaneal ligament, and also the ligament that keeps the talus in stable between the central tarsal bone and the talus, so the talocentral ligament, and also smaller intertarsal ligaments. There is relatively good outcome with this type of injury, and it's recommended that the luxation is reduced and held stable with a positional screw. And then again, I would use external coaptation for about 4 weeks, and then the dressing could be removed. And this is what the injury looks like. So we can see we have dorsal displacement of the talus here. We've got a small chip fracture up here, and then distally here we've got a gap between the talus and the central tarsal bone. So we've got a video here, and what we can see is that not all of these cases are treated surgically, and this particular case presented to us 3 weeks following injury. So the decision was made that because the hock joint was relatively stable, so the instability was purely dorsal, and the medial and lateral and plantar planes were all stable. So this cat was treated conservatively, and despite its injuries, 4 weeks after its injuries, you can see that it's still able to walk pretty well. And as a result, this cat didn't need surgery. But if it was presented in the acute phase, undoubtedly, the morbidity that this patient suffered would be minimized by early surgical intervention. So then we talk about talar fractures. Now, these type of fractures are relatively infrequent, and the reason is that the talus is relatively well protected in between the tibia and in in between the tibial cochlea and the medial and lateral malleoli. And if we do see these types of fractures, though, they can be divided into either intra-articular fractures or extra-articular fractures. So the extra-articular fractures include fractures of the tail of body and the neck, and the intra-articular fractures include fractures that extend into the actual joint itself, so into the tibio-talar joint. Chip fractures can be either reattached if the fragment is large enough, and that can be done with K-wires or lag screws, which are countersunk so that they are placed beneath the articular cartilage. And to get exposure to these type of fractures, it's often necessary to do an osteotomy of the medial malleolus, which is then reattached with a pin and tension band later on. Or smaller chip fractures, which are too small to be reattached, can be removed. Extra-articular fractures that include transverse fractures of the necks can be treated with cross K wires or potentially positional screws or lag screws, depending on the orientation of the fracture. But then I would use adjunctive treatment with an external skeletal fixator, temporary external skeletal fixator, just while those fractures heal. So this is a fracture of the neck of the talus, but we can see this is extra-articular because the tarsal crural joint looks intact, so we've got good visualization here. Here there's rotation on the craniocaudal view or the dorsoplantar view, so that we don't see the typical medial and lateral talar ridges like we do see, but that's because of there's rotation. So the foot here is pretty straight, but the tibia here is not straight, so that's why we're getting that kind of image there. But when we look in the lateral view, the tarsal crural joint is intact. So this could be treated with a temporary transarticular fixation following reduction of the fracture. This case, however, is a bit more challenging, and we can see there is a comminuted fracture of the articular surface, and it's not possible to reconstruct this type of fracture, and so this case here would almost certainly end up with a pantarsal arthrodesis. So there are various salvage procedures available to us, as we discussed. So whether that be a partial tarsal arthrodesis, so a fusion of all of the tarsal joints distal to the tarsal crural joint, or a pantarsal arthrodesis, fusion of all of the joints, including the tarsal crural joint, will depend on the nature of the instability and at what level it is. If their wounds present, then we might decide that we don't want to put internal fixation, and it's possible to do a tarsal arthrodesis using an external skeletal fixation as well. And are there financial constraints, and is there a chance that multiple procedures may be required? And if finances are an issue and there's a chance that multiple procedures may be required, then it may be appropriate to do an amputation straight off. But the vast majority of cases, it's possible to salvage the injuries to the distal limb with appropriate stabilization by either using a partial tarsal or a pantarsal arthrodesis. So just to recap, what does arthrodesis actually mean? So arthrodesis is the irreversible surgical fusion of two or more bones of a joint. So if we have, as we discussed before, if we have a tarsal crural joint injury, at that level, then we do a pantarsal arthrodesis and we fuse all joint levels of the hock joint. And those indications typically include unreconstructable articular fractures, persistent instability following previous stabilization methods, end-stage degenerative joint disease, tarsal crural luxations that can't be stabilized, and injury to the common calcaneal tendon, such as degenerative type injuries that we might see. If you have an acute traumatic injury to the common calcaneal tendon or the Achilles mechanism, these are often amenable to primary fixation and again protection with a transarticular external skeletal fixator or a tibiocalcaneal screw. So when we talk of a pantarsal arthrodesis, then It has been described that the plates can be placed either medially or dorsally or even laterally in dogs. But in cats, generally, we're talking about either dorsal plating or medial plating. And this was a study that looked at dorsal plating of the for a pantarsal arthrodesis. And in this study, they had 8 out of 9 return to normal activity, and 6 out of 7 had radiographic union, and only one case had plate failure. Subsequently, the plate has been designed so that at the level of the bend of the plate at this point here, it has become thicker, and it's recommended that when the screws are placed through the talus here, that you try and get the screws engaged in the calcaneus as well. My preference would be medial plating though in these cases, because it's relatively straightforward to do. It's just a standard medial approach. You're straight onto the bone. You have to do an ostectomy of the medial malleolus, and once you do that, then you get a really flat surface in which you can apply your medial plate. And biomechanically, a medial plate is potentially stronger than a dorsal plate because it is edge loaded. And so this is a case here which had a previous arthrodesis with external skeletal fixator. And we can see here we've got fusion of the distal intertarsal joints here. We've got good bridge of bone here and all the way down here, but it's failed at the level of the tarsocrural joint. So this was revised with a medial plate. So it was a medial pantarsal arthrodesis that was performed. The ends were osteotomized to get a flat surface, and then they were compressed using the plate and bone grafted at the same time. And this is a neat little trick that you can do if you do need to do an ostectomy off the to do a pantarsal arthrodesis, is you can place a K wire which is perpendicular to the long axis of the bone here. So the long axis of the bone here is you place a K wire there, which is perpendicular. You place another K wire there, which will help decide your angle, and then you can use a goniometer to measure this angle here. So typically in cats, we're talking about 120 degrees. So what we want to do is take a 30 degree triangle here, approximately a 30 degree triangle distally, and then when we compress it together, we should be left of a lang angle of around 120 degrees. And we can see here, you can also, if you have open wounds as well, it's possible to do a pantarsal arthrodesis with a transarticular frame as well. And again, these frames are typically kept on for longer than with a temporary transarticular fixation, for probably anywhere from about 4 to 5 months before we get union. But you follow these up radiographically, and you make your decision of when you're going to remove your frame based on your radiographic findings. So a partial tarsal arthrodesis is performed when their condition affects the proximal intertarsal joints, so distal to the tarsocrural joint, or any of the or the tars or if the tarsometatarsal metatarsal joint is affected. It is contraindicated if the tarsocrural joint is affected, and various different techniques have been reported, ranging from an external skeletal fixation, pin and tension band, and bone plating. And this is a study that was performed in dogs, but it looked at the different complication rates of lateral plate fixation, tension band wiring, or pin and lag screw fixation for calcaneoquartal instability. And the conclusion of the paper is that you're likely to have reduced complications if you use lateral bone plating compared to a lag screw fixation for calcaneoquartal arthrodesis. So my preference in these cases would be to use a fixation with a lateral plate. Again, these are the different types of injuries that we can see. So we've seen these before. So we need to work out whether this foot is viable or not, given that it's also got a concurrent large degree of soft tissue injury here, as well as its tarsocrural luxation. And this is another case that we saw previously, which had an avulsion fracture of the proximal aspect of the fifth metatarsal. And so in that case, we could see in the stress radiographs it was unstable, and a lateral plate was performed and a partial tarsal arthrodesis was performed. Typically, this plate would be longer, but this cat also had a fracture of the metatarsal bone here. So, as a result, the plate was applied. Was applied that would The plate that was applied was slightly shorter, but we can see that this fracture has gone on to heal distally as well. And then finally, we can see this is the radiograph that I first put up of a cat which had suffered an injury to its tarsocrural joint, or what I should say, in the region of its tarsocrural joint. Because if we actually look carefully, this is not a tarsocrural luxation. This is a physeal fracture. So we can see the malleolus is fractured here, but we can actually visualize the tarsocrural joint at this level here, and the fracture is proximal to the tarsocrural joint. So this case was stabilized with cross K wires, and the K wires were left in situ, but depending on the age of the animal at the time of injury, it may be that these K wires are removed at a later date. But typically, by the time these animals have had suffered injury to their physis, the growth potential has been retarded. And this cat was already 8 months of age, so most of its growing had been done. So in this case, the K wires were left in intact. Left in situ, the dressing was applied for approximately 4 weeks and was then removed, and then the fracture went on to heal. And that's it, chaps. So, if anyone has got any questions, feel free to post them. But otherwise, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you found it an informative webinar. Thank you very much. Bye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Elvin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.